I'm working on this book right now, consider my administrative responsibilities, taking a leave of absence for a full semester to be able to concentrate and finally digest all the material I have collected and try to write it down. And so the rails are on my head in some sense because I'm so preoccupied with them. And much of my talk will be kind of about that early period, very interesting period. It has implications for scientific communication, maybe not so much directly, but in terms of the speed of diffusion of technologies and how society reacts to dramatic new revolutionary advances. So I'll talk about communication as well. This part, I have a few, only a few illustrations, almost all drawn from Punch, of that early railway period. This is just one cartoon. It's not so directly relevant, just illustrates how often public attention is drawn to almost irrelevant things. So railways very quickly they showed up, they displaced horse-drawn coaches. England had a very well-developed system of stage coaches, which allowed fairly efficient communication. Railways displaced it and gave rise to a huge preoccupation with safety. Now, anytime anybody looked at statistics, it was clear that railways, even though they're horrendously dangerous by today's standards, they're far, far safer than stagecoaches. But no, that didn't affect public discourse. And indeed, when sometimes people would point out that rail travel was safer than coach travel, then there would be responses such as that from the Times of London in one of their editorials, saying, well, yes, but coaches are drawn by horses and horses are temperamental animals. You have to make allowances for it, whereas railroads are human creations. They really should be controlled and provide proper security. Okay? It's very hard to predict how society is going to react to a new innovation, and very often the reaction is in many ways irrational. Okay? But that's simply how it is, and we observe it today in the United States. Each year, about 40,000 people die in car accidents. You don't really read too much about that. On the other hand, suppose a plane crashes with 100 fatalities, then it's up, the top of the news, for a long, long time afterwards. Again, not necessarily maybe rational, strict economic sense, but simply how society reacts. And that's what complicates predictions or planning in terms of new technologies. And also that, of course, affects how people communicate in scientific communities or elsewhere, just because of this human element on top of the uncertainties about technology. So these are the kinds of topics I'll be talking about. One of the things that has, a little bit of background, I got seriously into scientific communication just about 15 years ago. I was asked by American Mathematical Society to kind of chair a little committee studying copyrights. That got me into more deeper investigation of the way scientific or mathematical and general scientific communication was being conducted. That took quite a bit of time and gave me already an appreciation for some of these human elements and unpredictability and inertia in the system, which kind of conditioned me to look at rosy predictions with a skeptical mind. That also led to this work on internet doubling and some other myths that did so much to inspire the bubble. And more recently, I got interested in the British Railway Manual of the 1840s, and that gave me an even deeper perspective on some of these issues. I'll get back to the British Railway Manual. Why that particular episode? Well, it was the greatest technology mania in history. If you compare it to the size of the economy, nothing compares to it. The whole internet bubble in the United States involved real capital investments. I'm not talking about astronomical stock market valuations. I'm talking about the money that was spent digging the ditches for the fiber optic cables, paying for the servers, data centers, and other kinds of things, and paying the software programmers. That was maybe $200 billion. Maybe 2% of US GDP, and of course some other sums elsewhere, spread over maybe 4 years or so. Okay? In Britain, at the height of the British Railway Mania in 1847, they were spending 8% of GDP in that single year. They had an army of about 300,000 workers, So for England, say England, for Ireland was a little bit different. England, Scotland, and Ireland had a population of about 20 million. 300,000 people were out there, you know, digging those, building up the embankments, digging cuttings, tunnels, etc., etc. And of course, there were spillover effects. That's compared to our current, say, U.S. population, it's about 5 million people. It's an army of workers, that's almost all manual labor, which picks and shovels and wheelbarrows, etc., doing all that work. Huge, huge investment. And of course, it was inspired by the dreams of effortless riches, which were kind of promoted by a variety of people in the period. And then it collapsed. Okay. But anyway, so this was a case where people got inspired. They thought that they really had a revolutionary technology. And one of the key problems they faced was a similar one as with the internet bubble. So with the internet, I think one of the maybe fatal, maybe the big fatal mistake was the assumption that things were now changing on internet time. And one of the really amazing analogies between internet bubble and British railway mania is also a very similar expression they used in those days, railway speed. They didn't use railway time. Railway time meant something else, as the uniform time that, you know, was being imposed on society by railway travel, etc. But they were talking very frequently about railway speed, legislating at railway speed, you know, rushing things through, and so on. Okay? And that was really kind of a key fault. All of these lines that were built during the mania, they were actually used. More lines were built later. I'll then show you some examples. Okay? It's just that they ruined the investors. They built too early. Didn't plan properly. And we see various things. So the scientific communication. So one of the things that has been kind of puzzling me is, why didn't the move towards, you know, online publishing and towards open access and various kinds of new collaborative methods for peer review and collaboration, other things, why didn't it happen faster? Some things did happen very fast on internet time. Remember, things like Google, I mean, Google took over in a space of about a year or so since it showed up. And how many people here remember Alta Vista? Okay, well, so I guess that's an old enough audience, so 10 years ago. I mean, Alta Vista was what people were using. And then Google suddenly came in and knocked it out of running. And now you talk to students, what's that? They have no memory of it, the freshmen in college. And Paul's Leno server, the preprint server, that took over in his area, I guess, again, in a matter of months. And then took over many other sub-disciplines, very often, again, in a matter of a year or two, essentially on internet time. Then the human element, the networks of people inside a sub-discipline reacting with each other, this mass psychology and sociology, etc., led them to switch into this kind of fairly quick phase transition. But overall, at the moment, the estimate is only about 15% of all the science, technology, medicine papers are open access. Even after, was it 18 years or so, operation of Leno, which, of course, there are other preprint servers, but that was a kind of proof of concept, show that it could be done, could be run very inexpensively. And after 18 years, we're only up to 15%. And that's some of this I saw early on, and I was kind of very puzzled by it. I've been looking at it. And we see it. So certain types of changes take a long time. Here is an example, and well, I'm a mathematician, or originally at least. This is a kind of a particular measure of the degree of collaboration among mathematicians. So data set here is papers reviewed by MathReviews. As was mentioned in one of the earlier presentations, I mean, MathReviews looks at about 100,000 papers per year currently, and reviews about 50,000, which classifies as core mathematics. And it started in 1940. So database is MathReviews. When they started in 1940, about 96 or so percent of the papers were singly authored. Okay, that's the top line over there. Okay, so single author started out around, you know, maybe 94% or so. It has come down in the year, I guess this only goes up to 1999, it was down to about 44%. Okay. Two author papers, they were down around maybe 5% back in 1940, And this went up to was about 25% in the year 2000. And three or more author papers, which were practically unheard of in 1940, they kind of grew to 8 or 10% in 2000. Clear signs of substantial change taking place in the discipline. Now, there's nothing special about mathematics. Other people have drawn similar graphs for other disciplines. Some disciplines have made this change sooner. Some still haven't made it. Look at philosophy papers and the author papers. And this is way before the internet. What was happening here? Well, a variety of things. Better communication, better postal service initially, better telephone, but then, of course, the internet as well. Better communication, inexpensive air travel, and dependable air travel, help, more conferences, more funding, et cetera, et cetera. And also just the internal developments of the discipline, fields getting more complicated, more opportunities as the interfaces of subfields, therefore that encourages people to work together to combine strengths in this case. But also substantial change happening. Again, the internet, it's not clear, you know, that we can point to any particular year and saying that suddenly the internet kicked in and made a dramatic change. It may be either accentuated or maybe just enabled continuation of the trend that has been in process all this time. But 60 years. So really substantial change, but it takes two generations here. Some things happen on internet time. The general rule of thumb for some technology, some diffusion of some technologies seems to be about 5 to 10 years. It's like the great quote from Jack Licklider. So Jack Licklider is probably the person best qualified to be called the grandfather of the internet. He's a psychologist by training, very interesting guy. He started the program that led to the internet, and he also wrote some very influential papers in the early 1960s, especially Bob Taylor, saying that the computer was really a device for communications. It was not really for number crunching. And then the program director at DARPA started a program that led to the ARPANET and then to the internet. Even before he got to DARPA, he led a program at MIT Stinson Lab on looking at libraries. And he published a book called Libraries of the Future, around 64 or so. It had two pieces to it. One piece was really wrong. He was expecting AI to advance very rapidly. It was wrong. The approaches that he regarded as being kind of core AI, kind of true AI, through artificial intelligence, they just have, you know, kind of failed. On the other hand, the second piece was one of the best pieces of futurology I have seen. He looked at trends in technology and said digital libraries will be practical by about year 2000. Almost right on the spot. Just simply said, well, how fast is processing power, memory, and other kinds of things improving? He says that by about year 2000, they'll be capable of handling the volume of information that a place like Library of Congress contains. That was just about right. In that book, he has a quote, says, people commonly overestimate what can be done in 1 or 2 years and underestimate what can be done in 5 to 10 years. And actually, the way he quotes, he says it's said, so he's not claiming originality for it. I have not been able to find an earlier citation to that particular thing. But that actually is a very good kind of estimate. You look at how quickly things diffuse, switching from, say, black and white to color TV. Look at diffusion of DVDs, VCRs, and other consumer products, other technologies, 5 to 10 years. Very common. Occasionally things happen on internet time. Prototypical example of that is the browser. The Mosaic, that is, of course, not today's Firefox, when it showed up, it kind of in a space of about a year, year and a half, it overtook all other methods for accessing information on the internet and led to a big spurt in traffic and really changed the world. Again, this is very special. Some
Yes, well, of course,
that's right. That's what motivated the kind of the claim of internet time in general. But it very seldom happens, except that there's one other circumstance which leads to change occurring on internet time when you have forcing agents. When somebody with power decrees, something shall happen. An interesting example is that of small denomination of banknotes. Canada switched successfully to the kind of loonie and toonie, okay? But they did it only because government decreed that paper dollar bills would not be valid currency beyond a certain point. Okay? And so people grumbled, but they accepted loonie and toonie, and other, from what I understand, people are happy. That's also true in other countries. United States has never been willing to enforce it. They has made several attempts to introduce various types of dollar coins, and they all failed. Making another attempt, and looks like that one's going to fail as well. Society sometimes is very reluctant to make a change. Why? It seems like a no-brainer. It's much simpler to use coins, and vending machines are easier to handle, et cetera, et cetera. Well, we don't want to do it. Yogi Berra had a great saying. He says that, well, if people don't want to come to the ballpark, there is little you can do to stop them.
Okay.
And that's very true. Okay. Now, of course, there is a kind of corollary or another side point to it. So if you don't build a ballpark, people definitely will not come to it. Okay. And that again makes you think about what it is or how society arranges itself to try to encourage innovation. Okay. And to what extent sometimes it actually encourages people to take a blinkered view. But anyway, so rates of change, that's something that was very important very clearly from early on. In my first serious paper in this topic, Tragic Loss or Good Riddance, was written in 1994, published early 1995, I kind of predicted that conventional scholarly journals were going to change dramatically, but no sooner than 10 years and likely no more than 20 years. So the first part of it has been true. Second part, well, maybe it's going to be true, but maybe not. Okay. The inertia in the system is huge. Again, what did I mean by dramatic change or collapse of traditional paper system? Well, I didn't define it, so of course it gives me some leeway to claim success. It's something that happens. And potentially it might come true if we really switch over to almost universal open access. And that may yet happen. But a couple of years later, I published another article on slow evolution of scholarly publishing, where I looked at rates of change in our society. Say, when we talk about these forcing agents, say, look, given the inertia in the scholarly publishing system, the only way you're going to get a dramatic change is if you have people who are going to really push for it, have forced to do it. And I think that's true, and we're seeing some mandates coming. I was also very wrong. It was because I was working in industry at that time at AT&T Labs Research. Namely, I was suggesting that it would be college presidents or provosts who would decree open access. Not having worked in academia, I didn't understand that presidents and provosts don't have much power. Okay? So it was a no-brainer to say that I was wrong in that case. And but funding agents are in a different situation. And I think that's what's leading to greater change. And also, of course, internal movement within the faculty. So like the decree from the Harvard Faculty of Arts and Sciences in favor of mandatory open access. These kinds of things, again, can have a big effect. Somebody really pushes things, mandates it. And I mean, you can really enforce it. I think Paul was saying, he just had a chat with one of the Harvard faculty members who I guess wasn't really aware of this decree. Well, that person may learn about it if, say, the Faculty of Arts and Sciences or his or her department decrees that the only papers that will be considered for promotion, tenure, or raises will be the ones which are in open access. Okay? That's the way to catch people's attention. That's right. Well, for young people, probably tenure will be more important. So, question is, what can you say? And so I'll be about rates of change. So I'll be talking about largely sort of about the difficulty of forecasting how society reacts to technology, and we'll illustrate it with examples from the British Railway Mania. But let me first, since we've talked a lot about Google and about, you know, kind of browsers and search and so on, let me illustrate the difficulty of technology. Well, it's not just technology forecasting, it's also a business model and people's attitudes and all the other things that go towards a success, say, on the web. So here is a quote from a conference. It was a web conference exactly 10 years ago in 1998, where the authors said that the, in context of web search, they said, the goals of the advertising business model do not always correspond to providing quality search to users. We expect that advertising-funded search engines will be inherently biased towards the advertisers and away from the needs of the consumers. But we believe the issue of advertising causes enough mixed incentives that it is crucial to have a competitive search engine that is transparent in the academic realm. Sounds, you know, quite convincing, right? And of course, given success of Google, which has done everything just wrong according to this prediction, you would think that these guys probably shorted Google and did its IPO and are broke. Okay. Well, you might think so, but if you did think so, you'd be wrong. Okay. This was Sergey Brin and Larry Page. Okay. Which shows you that you can be wrong and still be successful. Okay. And in fact, that is the kind of fairly common pattern in history, that often the kind of inventors or promoters of new technologies do not really understand what it is that society is going to find that's going to be most attractive about the invention. And well, I want to, let me now start talking about railroads, where I will show a bunch of examples. So I mentioned Railway Mania. So this is another cartoon from Punch from 1845. As a height of the mania, so the giant sort of locomotive, and everybody is there either prostrate or you know, kind of kowtowing to it or riding on it, so on. And this was a really crazy piece. I mentioned, you know, huge amounts of money being invested, of course, on the premise or the promise that people are, the investors were going to get rich off of it, was going to revolutionize society. And he did that to a large extent. And the railroad, kind of was developed under wrong impressions. So railway development is quite old. In some sense, people trace it back often to the 16th century. Basically, you know, but you know, real development started going in the 18th century. What England, in particular, was facing was deforestation, as well as exhaustion of the coal mines that are conveniently located to canals and rivers. So now they're digging deeper and deeper, and you know, further and further from nice navigable waterways, and so they had a problem of somehow carrying the coal to the ultimate destination. So transport was becoming a real problem. Again, when you talk about say venture capitalists, if you say an inventor, you have a great idea, you know, better mousetrap, and you think you're going to get rich off of it, and I want the backing, they very many of them have a very succinct question. Say, what itch are you scratching? Why would people care? Is there a crisis that anybody faces that would make them go for your better mousetrap? If there's not a crisis, well, why worry about developing and marketing it? Well, with transport, with railways, it wasn't an itch. It was a searing pain. It was a real, real serious problem. The price of coal in England would double within 10 miles of the mouth of the mine, simply because of the cost of horses on transport. So it's a very serious problem, and so people, of course, were thinking about it, and sort of, well, as I mentioned, rails were already kind of under development, had been under development for some centuries. By the end of the 18th century, they're moving away from planks, wooden planks, towards iron rails. And of course, steam engine was being developed, James Watt, end of the 18th century or so. Marriage of the two, kind of iron rail and steam engine, was a very natural one. Took a long time. Again, George Stephenson and other predecessors deserve a lot of credit. But it finally kind of was implemented. And when it was first implemented, it was implemented for coal, short distance coal transport. Again, you know, mine mouth was getting further and further away from navigable waterways, so we just simply used the locomotive to carry the coal to the barge. So, and so the initial plans were all for transport of goods over short distances. The first public kind of railway was, that was publicness was available for many people to use, was the Stockton and Darlington Railway, opened in 1825. The next one was the Liverpool-Manchester Railway. That one was authorized in 1826, 1825, opened in 1830. When they planned it, they actually didn't know how they're going to power it. They were considering either horse-drawn wagons or stationary steam engines pulling the wagons by rope or locomotives. And while they were building the railway, putting down the rails, they were investigating the best motive power. Pretty kind of astounding they would think about it. Anyway, when they planned it, when they got authorization from Parliament, they again thought about freight transport. Liverpool and Manchester were these two kind of coupled cities, 30 miles apart. Liverpool was a harbor, became the principal harbor for England. Manchester was the manufacturing town. Coal would come in, so coal and also cotton would come into Liverpool, had to be transported to Manchester, be manufactured into, you know, cotton goods and other things, and would have to be taken out again. There was canal transport, was expensive. There was a cartel of the canals, which kept prices high. Service was inadequate, so the merchants and other folks in those two cities promoted, were willing to risk quite a bit on the idea of the new technology. So they developed built this railway for goods transport, connecting the harbor city with the manufacturing city. There was no thinking at all about passengers. Amazingly enough, in the first few years of the railway, something like 80% of the revenues came from passengers. It turned out, actually, they had some inkling about it. I mean, there were smart people who were talking to folks. They also saw what was happening at Stockton Darlington. So even before the railway opened, they already kind of were gearing up for passenger kind of traffic. But anyway, it still caught them by surprise how much demand there was. It turns out that what society really cared about was less kind of low cost and relatively speedy transport for goods. They cared a lot about speedy passenger. So they didn't know it. Okay. Well, but anyway, so this was a successful railway. It led to a mania, the first railway mania in England, early 1830s. And this mania involved building some so-called trunk railways, long-haul railways. So Liverpool to Manchester is 30 miles. Okay. And it's two cities that are kind of really intimately tied, dependent on each other in many ways. Now promoters go out and kind of solicit funding to build long-haul railways. London to Birmingham, about 100 miles, and then a line from Birmingham up to Liverpool, Manchester, another 100 lines, still another line from London to Bristol, Great Western Railway, about 100 miles, yet another one from London to Southampton, again about 100 lines. And they succeed. They attract investors. And there are skeptics. And I know some of them are really very, very sensible. In particular, I mean, this is just one of them, but I found a really beautiful letter published in 1836. None of these lines are in service yet. They are under construction. This guy in 1836 writes this long letter predicting woe to all the investors. And he, in particular, manages to predict almost to a T the trouble that has struck Eurotunnel. So the tunnel between England and France was opened, I guess, almost 20 years ago. It went essentially to bankruptcy. Okay. Well, one was almost a formal bankruptcy. Second one, more recent, was another reorganization. Each time the shareholders got wiped out. This guy predicted almost exactly what was going to happen. So after discussing railways, he said, well, people are also proposing a suspension bridge from England to France. at that project, you're talking both about the suspension bridge and about the tunnel. Both projects go back to Napoleonic times, and was a quite active promotion for both projects all through the 19th century. We find the Gaza Channel, you know, channel built about 20 years ago. Anyway, so he was writing in the context of the proposed suspension bridge, and he says, well, it's all very well and good, but these guys, promoters, forget about two things. One is they forget the engineers always underestimate costs. And second, he says, they assume that all the traffic, you know, that now goes between England and France is going to use their bridge. You know, the ships are not going to disappear, they are going to continue competing. Okay? And so he says they are going to lose their shirt. Well, exactly right about Eurotunnel. Actual costs turn out to be 70% higher than expected and estimated. Traffic today is about half what had been estimated. Why? Because promoters of the Eurotunnel 20 years ago, and it was being approved, they assumed that they would, that everybody would use the tunnel. As in those days, air travel was cartelized. These government-owned monopoly carriers that charged very high prices, so they didn't think that, you know, air travel could compete. They couldn't imagine Ryanair springing up and offering, you know, cut rate flights across the channel. And second, they assumed the ferries would also fold and move to other routes. Instead, ferry companies invested in larger, more efficient ships, and they still hang on to a large chunk of the traffic. So your tunnel failed. The guy was almost exactly right about it. But he was wrong about the rail. He was half wrong about the railways. He was still right about engineers. Engineers still underestimated costs. The actual lines, when they're completed, almost uniformly cost about twice what had been promised and estimated. But traffic actually met projections. How did that happen? Well, that's a very interesting topic I'm kind of investigating for my book. It's amazing because the success or the great achievement of the people who are estimating the traffic, so for traffic takers, has not really been documented before. So, extremely accurate. They're more accurate than road planners are today. You think, you know, today, you know, we know what the technologies are. We're not talking about, you know, rocket travel. We're talking about, you know, either mass transit, you know, trains, or we're talking about automobiles and buses. Okay, we have, you know, a century of experience. We have sophisticated mathematical models. We have all sorts of demographic data, etc., etc. Surely, you know, our road planners could figure out how much traffic there would be when they built a new superhighway or bridge, or etc. No, not really. A very large mistakes they make. Traffic takers in the mid-1830s hit the nail almost exactly on the head by mistake, or rather by cancellation of mistakes. Okay? They're making some assumptions which turn out to be wrong. Okay? The basic mistake they made, they assumed that the demand for travel would be between endpoints. So, you know, the people would travel from London to Birmingham. Okay, or London up to Manchester. Okay. And it took a long time for people to realize, I mean, statistics were, and one of the interesting things is that happens fairly frequently, as we know from history of technology, that people see things, or have things in front of their eyes, and they don't see them, or at least don't understand them. So they had the statistics, you know, right in front of them, but it took them about 15 years about the great crisis at the end of the great railway mania of the 1840s, when things collapse and they really look around, they realize that in fact most of the local traffic is local. Something Katy was talking about, you know, on the internet and in even the cyberspace social networks, there's a strong locality of traffic. What was a stronger locality of traffic on railways? Much of the demand was not from endpoint to endpoint, okay, but rather between intermediate points. But still, they made these assumptions, was cancellation of errors, and they came out with the right results. Okay? Another example where they again had things right in front of their eyes, but they were not kind of understanding it, that they were not seeing it properly, was with goods traffic. I mentioned to you that this was a great surprise for them when they realized that most of the demand delivered to Manchester Railway was from passenger travel, people carrying about fast transport. Yes, the next few lines were then planned. And there were reasons for it, again, things that are kind of reminiscent of some of the things we see today. For example, many of the factories in Manchester were built right on the canal, which meant that when, say, cotton was brought in from Liverpool, it could be delivered right to the factory. Well, railway provided faster transport for cotton, but it only provided it to the rail station. Now you had to get it from rail station to the factory. But of course, more convenient to have it shipped directly by canal. Eventually, yes, people realized there were some advantages to doing it by rail, and the rail sidings were invented. Other things were done, but it took a while. Took a while, but it was happening steadily, and people were not paying attention to it. Freight transport or revenues from freight transport were growing faster than from passengers all through the late 1830s and 1840s. And people were not paying attention to it up until, I think, about 1850. And by 1852, revenues from freight exceed revenues from passengers. People can be blinkered. But very often, when you have something really big, a big steamroller comes at you, you get an impression of it, and you don't look around and don't see other things that happen. Other slides. If you want to read about it a little bit, there's an amusing piece of fiction. It's on my homepage, but actually also in other places. Glenmutchkin Railway. It's a short story. It was written at the height of the mania by a Scottish chap, very interesting guy, very versatile. He was a lawyer. He was a professor of rhetoric. He was a newspaperman, a poet, etc., etc. Anyway, he wrote this short story to try to puncture the bubble. Published in fall of 1845 at the height of the speculative excitement, and has some really remarkable, you know, or noteworthy characters. The two protagonists are Augustus Reginald Dunshunner and Bob O'Corkindale. They abhorred work with a detestation worthy of a scion of nobility, and they were eager to have a pluck at a public pigeon, just like the many of the people involved in the dot-com bubble. And the kind of similarities to the dot-coms are really striking. To live through that period and were acquainted with any of the folks, you'll be amused. That's a short story. It will take about 15 or so minutes. But anyway, so here is, okay, that's some other things to show you. Oh, again, the issue I mentioned, the key mistake people made is overestimating the rate of change. So this was another cartoon shown in Punch, published in 1845. Again, this is the period when, you know, kind of the sky is the limit. And so there are 1,500 or 1,800 railway companies being promoted, soliciting funding from investors. And so and at that stage, England has a grand total of 2,000 miles of railways. So you have like a big, you have lines connecting all the major cities, but usually not directly, but you know, there's a skeleton system in there connecting it. You still don't have a connection to Scotland, because so Edinburgh and Glasgow are isolated, or they are connected to each other, about 40 miles apart, could only be connected by 1842, etc. So it's still a very, very sparse network, which I should have brought in and shown you a map of the railway system of 1845. Anyway, so Punch looked at it and looked at all the promotion and said, well, you know, here is this ludicrous thing those guys are trying to build. Okay, and they just scrolled various lines to the map of England and Wales. Well, amazingly enough, by 1855, 10 years later, when the construction of the mania had died down, rail system didn't look quite as dense as it does in this chart, but it wasn't that far from it. And by 1900, at which stage the rail system had tripled again. So 1845, you have 2,000 miles of railway. By 1855, you have about 6 or 7,000 miles. By 1900, you have 22,000 miles of railway. By year 2000, the rail system of England looks very much like this. I mean, it was a very powerful technology, okay, and sort of it just took a while for it to kind of have it to be fully developed. People just overestimated it. Some other things, again, I mean, lots of very amusing, well, I mean, instructive, but certainly many amusing stories can be told. Opposition in the early days, there's a lot of opposition, and actually one of the really amazing things is that Parliament, which was dominated by the landed interest, actually did allow the right of eminent domain to be used to acquire land, forcibly, but with compensation from the aristocrats. The aristocrat-dominated government allowed seizing of land for construction of railways. And, you know, but the promoters had to be careful not to arouse too much opposition. They often had to reroute the lines into less convenient or more expensive routes in order to avoid fox hunting grounds of particular dukes or lords of one type or another. So things change. Now, within a, you know, a few decades, there will be cases where some of these landowners would give the land for free because they realize there will be so much benefit to them to have a railway passing through. So they'll be donating land. So in the early days, they were trying to extract a lot of money as much as they could. So anyway, that's kind of the brief story of a really powerful revolutionary technology, which comes in where the promoters don't fully understand how it's going to be used. As it develops, they don't fully understand how it's being used even, but it barrels through because it deals with a very, very serious problem society has. In terms of scholarly communication, my view from the beginning was electronics the way to go. Simply because of the growing volume of information and growing specialization. You just couldn't possibly handle it through all the traditional paper means of communication. Everything else was a corollary. So yes, I'm certainly my predictions, I was wrong. I may still be wrong about the 20 years before dramatic change happens. I was wrong in expecting much greater number of small, totally free scholar-run journals. Among my colleagues, a number of them sprang up around the time I felt that was going to take over like wildfire. No, not to be very small. Journal change in academia has been smaller. Publishers have adapted somewhat faster. It may not seem all that fast, but in those days, remember when I was writing my paper and corresponding with people and some drafts were up for discussion, I was getting some letters excoriating me for praising electronics when all these people were still sorry that the card catalogs had gone away. Things have changed. In particular, I think publishers have adapted. One of the reasons publishers have done as well as they have, total revenues, they are still doing very well, is that they've managed to kind of move everybody or people at the leading research institutions to an environment which is very similar to what open access would provide. Again, you have to look at the different agents in the field, say, who is it that benefits from a particular change? Remember, most of the material, especially valuable material, is generated by scholars at universities. Yes, we have many sciences opening up. You have chances, and we have kind of demonstrable contributions from essentially amateurs to science. But the bulk is still coming from specialists working at leading institutions. And these people have already the effect of open access, even through the commercial publishers, because the librarians kindly arrange to pay the publishers so that when they kind of hit on a click, the paper shows up and they don't have to worry about the payment or anything else. So change certainly has been taking place. In some ways, as slow as I expected, some ways maybe even slower. Certainly in no case can I say it happened faster than I expected. Somewhat different, many somewhat different ways. I expect it's going to continue growing. I don't think we can predict precisely how it's going to develop. Some things, I've had many kind of debates with Stefan Harnett about kind of the evolving nature of peer review, some different views. I kind of feel that it's going to evolve, move towards much more open commentary and other kinds of things, but it's going to be slow, because that's sociology of science. And kind of the academic community is very resistant to change in terms of the basic practices. So yes, I think that's it's a great future. I think the movement is, I think, essentially irresistible. We just simply cannot live with the old traditional system just because of the growth in the volume of research output and the need for communication and collaboration across disciplines. But exactly how it's going to be channeled and what kind of media are going to play dominant roles, that is much harder to tell. So thank you very much.
Confused about, so the last thing you said, that there's a need for interdisciplinarity. And what's that got to do with open access? I mean, as far as I know, interdisciplinarity is an extremely painful business that works through huge amounts of discussion between people trying to learn each other's languages. Yes. It's not about reading papers, because you can make no head or tail of it unless you already know about that. So what are the two things got to do with you?
I think they are correlated. They are not the same, indeed. It is painful, but having access to the material easily, it certainly promotes access. I mean, my own work, I mean, I've been going back to the original material, not just punch, but you know, specialized railways, the articles, 2,000 or so, and other things. But I've also drawn very heavily on the work of economists, historians, accountants, and such like. I think, again, in this case, it was less a matter of open access, it was more of my being at Minnesota, which has a fairly good library and access to the electronic databases. But I think it's more general, too, again, opening it up to people who are not as fortunate as I am right now. So I think there is a correlation there.
I mean, sorry if I may just follow it up. I mean, I was very impressed. It was quite a couple of decades ago when a group at SPRU in Sussex did a study that showed that the optimum size of a research group is half a dozen if they're really going to talk to each other. I wouldn't have thought those half dozen would have a lot of difficulty getting at each other's papers, irrespective of the means of transmission. I mean, I can certainly agree with you that it's going to ease them. You know, one uses it all the time, one's finding our stuff all the time. But I can't see why you should expect it to transform them.
Well, transform things, I would say, transform things or maybe help natural motion and also help compensate for things. So, yesterday, during the discussions, I made the point that much of what we're doing in terms of promoting interaction simply compensates for the divergence and separation that's happening naturally because of the growth in science and increasing specialization and so on. It's sort of like paperless office. That's something I cut out of my presentation. There are many kind of very seemingly plausible predictions which haven't come through because you have two divergent or two opposing tendencies. Paperless office is one of them. It's really a great idea. But indeed, electronic technology makes it possible to read much more on the screen. On the other hand, the very same technology enables the production of inexpensive, convenient and reliable printers, which satisfy the latent demand, which was always there but could never be satisfied or so. As a result, we have a continuing increase in the consumption of paper in offices.
So, there's something else, but I actually want to ask Harry a question, which is, so suppose you were reading some article in biology, and all of the technical terms were marked up for you because it was open access and it was ingested. And when you got to the word kinase and you couldn't remember what it was, but it linked you to a glossary item in molecular biology of the cell, which is actually what you get if you look at the glossary view of something that's on PubMed Central. It's ideas like that that actually will, in a substantive way, help interdisciplinarity.
It's this business about whether you think of interdisciplinarity as exchanging information, or whether you think of it something like as a problem of bridging paradigm incommensurability. So here's an example. I wrote a book with a philosopher. We spent 2 months talking about action, and we realized after 2 months that we were talking right across each other because me as a sociologist and him as a philosopher had two completely different notions about what the word action meant. And it took us 2 months to work it out. all my experience of China, of too much to notice it, all my experience of this kind of thing is that you need to talk for about 2 years to somebody.
No, what I'm saying is you would have looked at this paper and seen instantly there are two notions of action. Sociologists think of this, philosophers think of that, and that would be up front.
It's not written down. It could be written down now, but it couldn't be written down then because neither of us knew it.
And it will be written down in 5 to 10 years, and there's your interdisciplinary future-based little finesse.
I mean, you have to also take into consideration that that's exactly what we're doing at the moment, is trying to create bridges between these. And you have a lot of sciences that are at the forefront of these interdisciplinary dynamics, like astrobiology. And when we had our first astrobiology conference when I was in Australia, it's like we were in a room this big with paleontologists, astrophysicists, geologists, and biologists, and we realized it was a joke because everybody trying to talk was talking their own language. And so we got little pink cards, and whenever anyone said a jargon, you know, somebody in astrobiology raised their hand for a biologist and said, I have no idea what you're talking about. And all of a sudden, we realized what was jargon, what was communication, and we're evolving these whole new realms of creating bridges and understanding, because there are a lot of disciplines now that are at the forefront of the interdisciplinarity of the sciences. So something like this with open access and access to all the different jargon words and things like this to make the bridges is really imperative for
us. But forgive me if I ask, but what are you doing in the same room?
Astrobiology.
Why aren't you all on the telephone to each other? It could have saved you all that trouble. You know, it happens in rooms.
Pink cards. Can't hold that pink card.
On the other hand, it helps you before you get to that room. You take a look at the other guys or girls, you know, papers. So you have some sense at least of what they are doing.
Can I just ask one more question? That in the previous talk with the mapping of the mapping of the scientific disciplines, why wasn't it like that map of the railway that you just put up? Why was there any structure? Why wasn't it all kind of uniform?
In cyberspace?
Yeah, I think. The previous lady's talk.
Yes, because, well, we just observed that it happens. There's still locality. We have some examples now of groups that are kind of somewhat purely kind of out there on the internet, yet when you look at interactions between players, they tend to be localized. Why? Common language, getting up at the same time of day, being a fan of the same sports team, whatever it is, it's not known. But I mean, this is something which was observed already about 150 years ago or more, so-called gravity loss. You look at any kind of interaction between the people, then typically the intensity of the interaction, if you have two centers, like say two cities, intensity of the interaction grows like product of the populations divided by the distance raised to a power, which is often like 1 or 2 or that you very subtle or so on. And so it was observed that people have come up with various models which lead to the kind of behavior, but there's no kind of general explanation because there are mixtures of things. It's not absolutely uniform, the exponent varies. And there are sometimes other geographical artifacts that come into it. And it's not, the initial explanation, very plausible explanation, this is due to the kind of transport costs, whether costs in terms of money or time. It takes time to go out and reach somebody, for communication telephone, you usually get charges depending on the distance. But we're finding it also even with postal services, which for example, postal pricing, you know, uniform pricing, was also true, and how we're finding it on the internet. So there's still a strong locality.
Regarding the discussion over here, I'm curious, why does open access necessarily lead to the vision that you're talking about, where he can, you know, find definitions and terms? The archives have been open access for over 10 years, and different fields of physics still don't know what they're talking about. It seems like we need something other than open access.
Open access is just one step promoting that. No, it's not a universal solution, absolutely. And I mentioned, in a way, because of what publishers and librarians have done, open access acts on the boundaries, enables people, so the amateurs who are not part of the club, you know, the elite institutions, also maybe faculty researchers at smaller liberal arts or other kinds of schools to participate. But again, it's still a small number. I think it's growing, I think that's encouraging, but it is still small. Most of science has been a province of specialists now for over a century. I don't expect this to change.
I mean, it's a good question. I would say the answer is it's neither necessary nor sufficient for this sort of thing. I was trying to give an example of where having, and the simplest possible example, where having these articles out there and the ability for people to ingest them and compute on them and at least in principle add these overlays is something that would be facilitated in principle by open access. And actually, there is a problem in physics that potentially we're behind the curve in a lot of these things because everybody takes us for granted, oh, you people have all of these articles out there, and we have fewer people actually building these services on top of it than you have in, for example, PubMed Central, which is the example I gave, where they started out behind and had this heavy investment of resources to charge out ahead. If you're willing to do it for physics, we'd love you for it.
Yeah, and in the EPRIT network, we have about 18 disciplines. And one of the things I noticed from the beginning and watching people's websites, and we have about 30,000 sites we can do for websites, is that different disciplines are moving at different paces. Of course, physics was started that out. Computer science, of course, is big, and I'm sure it's because they find computer science knows how to do it. And math is growing. Engineering has now got to the point that it's almost as big as physics as far as individual websites. Most people in physics makes it to the power site. But geology has taken off from that idea. Geology is big enough and it's big enough. And if you look, and what I've noticed also is that the principal attributions is where it takes place first. And that's exactly what's taking place right now in geology. It's the principal institutions in geology that's doing it. So I think what you said here is it takes time for people to get used to the idea. And it's taking time for people in different disciplines to get through. And in spite of the NIH thing, I don't see it in the profound medical sciences. I don't look in clinical sciences. But in physiology and cell biology, it's very sparse.
I think that may be a good segue into the next session, which is actually on the future of scientific collaboration. But we should thank Andrew for that.